United States Affairs to order. It's about 3 minutes after nine. We have present with us Senator Geisel, our vice chair, Senator Coghill, and Senator Wilikowski. Senator Stedman has said that he will be attending on at need. As usual, please turn off your cell phones. Today we're hearing Senate Bill SB 1, Alaska Mining Day, Senate Bill 2, Interstate Mining Compact and Commission, and Senate Bill 4, Training Credit. If you all are here, how many of you want to testify? All right, thank you. It is, if we are able, I'd like to move all three of these bills out, but it's absolutely your choice, and you please feel free to testify not as long as you want, but quite a bit. Are there any of you that have time constraints and need to get to another appointment? All right, thank you. All right. The first bill up then is Senate Bill 1. Senator Geisel, do you want to make the presentation from there or here? It's your choice.
Oh, I'll do it from here, I guess. Thank you, right. Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 1 is a very short bill. It's one page. It's in your packet. For the record, I'm Kathy Geisel, Senator for Senate District N. That's Nikiski and Turnagain Arm. North Kenai and Turnagain Arm. Senate Bill 1 would establish May 10th as Alaska Mining Day. That day was chosen because of the date in 1872 when the General Mining Act of the United States was adopted. The bill is quite short. You have substantive supporting documents with an inspirational overview of mining in Alaska, really highlighting the adventurous folks that and hardworking folks that came and established Alaska. You know, a lot of the infrastructure we enjoy in Alaska was originally built by the mining industry, and the most recent part of our infrastructure is actually here in Juneau. Another hydroelectric dam went in recently, just a few years ago, at Lake Dorothy to provide more hydroelectric power for the city of Juneau. This was needed because of the Greens Creek mine here, which is providing a substantial increase in employment opportunity here in Juneau. So this is just an example of the positive impacts of mining in our state. We also have a significant amount of rare earth elements. Today there's a lunch and learn about Bokan Mountain, which is a mining opportunity here in Southeast. In addition, there is an education program that goes around the state, Alaska Resource Education, which informs school kids about where a lot of their technology equipment comes from, basically mined elements, and inspires them hopefully to get into the mining industry, which provides some really excellent, good-paying lifetime jobs. So, Mr. Chair, with that, the bill establishes May 10th as Alaska Mining Day, and that concludes my presentation of the bill. There could be some folks available to testify on behalf of it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Geisel, have other states done, mining states, done something similar?
I don't know, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Good question.
All right. Well, proverbially, we don't care whether they do or not.
Pretty much.
I have on my list Ed Fogel. First to testify, please. He is Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, Deputy Commissioner. About to give you a promotion.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the thoughts there. Appreciate the invitation to come here and testify. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Ed Fogels. I'm one of the two deputy commissioners of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. This administration supports this bill, Senate Bill 1, which would establish May 10th as Alaska Mining Day. Mining has played a critical role in Alaska's history, as you all know, and it continues to play a critical role to this day in our history in our economy. While mining may seem overshadowed by oil and gas and the economy that oil and gas provides the state, mining does play a critical role in Alaska's economy. Mining has provided over 4,000 jobs that average about $100,000 a year each job. These are highly skilled jobs, engineers, environmental scientists, heavy equipment operators and mechanics, jobs that give you skills that are transferable to other sectors. Mining can provide great economic benefits to our poorest regions. An example is at the Red Dog Mine. It's the only taxpayer in the Northwest Arctic Borough, and that's provided huge benefits to the people of that region. Prospective projects like Donlin Gold could carry the economy of that region for many years and multiple generations. A large part of my job over the years has been to make sure that our mines are operating in an environmentally sound manner, to ensure we have a strong regulatory and permitting process. If you look at each of our seven mines that are operating in the state right now, they all have sound environmental records. We have staff out there looking at these projects and making sure they're in environmental compliance, and they're all doing very well in that respect. We're also working to strengthen our mining sector. We have a strategic and critical minerals initiative out there. We're collecting new data. Alaska is very underexplored. We have a lot of potential for a lot of new deposits that could benefit our state, and in particular our more rural regions. So all this is to say that mining is critical to Alaska's well-being, and I think it would be a wise move to remind the people of Alaska of this every May 10th on Alaska Mining Day. So thank you very much, sir, for the opportunity.
Anybody else like to testify on this bill? Mr. Vogel? It seems to me like there's more mining activity in the last decade or so here in Alaska than there has been for a long time. And some of the mines are world-class.
Yes, sir.
And most of them are financed with Canadian money.
Mr. Chair, I think your statements are all correct. In the last 10 years, we have seen, actually in the last 20 years, when I first started working for the Department of Natural Resources about 25 years ago, I think Greens Creek was just starting up and Red Dog were just starting up. And then the only other mine the state had at that point was Usabelli coal mine. And so since then, we've ramped up, and now we have seven, and two large mines are in permitting right now. So there's definitely an increase in interest in Alaska, investment money coming into Alaska. And a considerable amount of that is Canadian money through the Canadian Stock Exchange. There are reasons for that, but there are also mines. Sumitomo Metal Mine is a Japanese company that owns and operates the Pogo Mine. The Kensington Mine is the core mining, so they're an American company. So it's not entirely that every mine is financed by Canadian money.
Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of how the mining industry is taxed, or any money from the industry flows into the state coffers?
Sure. There are a number of ways. There's a royalty, which is a 3% royalty on profits, and then there's a corporate income tax, which I believe is 9%, and then the mining license tax, which is 7%. I'm pretty sure those are all correct. I have to refresh my memory at some point, but we'll make sure the committee understands that. But those are the state benefits that come in. The royalty would only apply if the mine were on state land. Keep in mind that for these large mine projects, the economic benefits are not just to the state coffers. They're very localized, and the jobs and the property taxes to the local governments are huge.
Right, and the last two you mentioned, those are taxes on their profits?
Correct.
All right. Thank you. Any questions in the committee? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Next person that wants to testify? Somebody raised their hand? Yeah. Identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Deantha Crockett. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill. Deputy Commissioner Fogels actually stole a lot of my thunder here. I was going to give you some stats about the benefits of the mining industry here in Alaska. To give you a little background, I know many of you are aware, but AMA is the sort of umbrella association that represents the mining industry in Alaska. The large projects that Deputy Commissioner Fogles referred to are in our membership, as well as a lot of very small mom-and-pop placer operations around the state, and contractors, vendors that do business with the mining industry, as well as coal in Alaska. So we really do have sort of anything that touches the mining industry, AMA really represents, and that's what my association does. I do have brand new numbers for 2012 here that I'd like to share very briefly. McDowell Group does a report for us every year on the economic benefits of the mining industry to the state. In our 2012 numbers are 4,800 direct mining jobs, 9,500 direct and indirect jobs, so total 9,500. As Deputy Commissioner mentioned, these are from about 120 communities. So in places where there really is not a diverse economy, these people have year-round high-paying full-time jobs, the average wage of which is $100,000. It's a very, very beneficial industry in terms of jobs. Combined with the benefits that we have today and the history that we've got in the state for mining, I just think it's a real great thing to have Alaska Mining Day. I'm happy to answer any questions you guys might have.
I assume you're in favor.
Very much in favor. Thank you.
Senator Giesel.
Ms. Crockett, could you review the economic benefit to the native corporations who sometimes are the landowners on which a mine is located?
Through the chair, yes, I sure can, Senator Giesel. I've got some numbers here for you in regards of, just to give you a background, Deputy Commissioner Fogles referred to the Red Dog Mine, which is, of course, on Nana Land, was done through a unique partnership in which Teck is the operator, was Cominco at the time when it started, and Nana is the landowner. And they went into a partnership together in which many of the decisions, the permitting, what goes on now has been done through Nana Corporation and Teck. The Northwest Arctic borough in which this mine is located, a Red Dog mine, is the only taxpayer in that borough. Most of our mines are either the largest or the only taxpayer in the boroughs in which they're located, and when they are in organized boroughs. Finally, in case of the Red Dog, 60% of their jobs at Red Dog are in Nana shareholders. So it's a hugely profitable thing for our native corporations here. We could largely expect to see the same thing with the Donlin project going through permitting. I know at their man camp, they have 90% Calista shareholder hire there. So it's a very, very beneficial thing to our native corporations. So did that answer your question?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I would just add a comment, Chair Dyson, that in my view, it's very well done there, and I hope it's being done that well. But I think the state financed the building of the road, and then every truck that runs down the road helps to repay that loan.
That's correct.
And I'm told that Tech Minko has, in addition to training and hiring local people, allows the clinic to be used, helps the locals buy fuel at the same rate they do, and sometimes has allowed on the backhaul, the barges coming up, local equipment for others to be able to come up on the barges, use the airport.
Mm-hmm.
Anything I've missed?
One thing, Senator Dyson, through Chairman Dyson, is that in addition to that, they have been very instrumental in evacuating some villages during major storms in the last 5 to 10 years. They have been the ones that have sent the air support in to get people located safer ground.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Anybody else want to testify? Sir.
Thank you very much, Chair Dyson, and the rest of the committee for hearing SB 1 today. My name is Mike Satry. I was born and raised here in Southeast Alaska, and Juneau is my home. I'm currently the executive director of the Council of Alaska Producers. We're a trade association representing the large producing metal mines and major metal development projects in the state of Alaska. We fully support this bill, but I want to take a slightly different tact in my testimony today. We've talked about the economic benefits. We've talked about the infrastructure that has helped us build our state. But Mining Day will also help us recognize the individuals that have built this state through coming to this area with the mining industry. One of the perfect people that would have been able to testify on this bill, unfortunately, passed away last year. Many of us know him. He was former Deputy Commissioner of Labor, David Stone. If David was here today, he would be able to wax eloquently for the entire time that this committee would be in session about the individuals who came here, worked in the mining industry, were true giants within the mining industry, here in Juneau, building the hydroelectric projects, building the mines, being the first people up in Fairbanks with the gold dredges, building the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And he would have been able to talk about these people as if they were right here in the room with us. David Stone, in addition to all of his work on behalf of the mining industry, was also a preeminent mining historian here in the state. I think it's important that we recognize the individuals who have worked in the mining industry throughout the years, and we will be able to recognize him through the establishment of Mining Day, and we'll also be able to recognize David Stone and for his contributions to the industry for many years to come. So we thank you for hearing this bill. We hope that we can establish permanently establish Alaska Mining Day in the future, and welcome any questions you might have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else want to testify? Any questions or comments from committee members? Chair will entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move that we move Senate Bill number 1 from committee with individual recommendations and attach fiscal note.
Is there objection? Senate Bill 1 is moved from committee on to the next committee of referral, which I think is finance.
Actually, there is no fiscal note, Mr. Chair. It is a zero fiscal note.
Yeah, good. Right to rules. All right. We'll take a moment here while we get the signatures at ease.
Actually, the dues are calculated, and the executive director can give you the real lowdown on this. First of all, half of the Interstate Mining Compact's budget is divided by the number of members, and that portion is paid by each state. But then there is an additional accrual based on how much mined resource each state produces. There is a chart in your materials which will show you what the different states' dues are right now. The highest-paying dues member right now is West Virginia. There is a cap on the amount of dues that you would pay, and West Virginia produces so much mined minerals that they actually exceed that cap, and so they're capped at $56,000 a year. But other states, it is based on how much mineral they mine.
To follow up, may I infer then that the $35,000 is based upon our present level of activity? And might go up or down?
That is correct. Okay. Should our mined resource increase.
All right. I have, I think, online Gregory Conrad. Can you hear us, sir?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chairman.
All right. And we'll turn your voice up, but cozy up to the mic and speak loudly, and we'd be delighted to hear your testimony. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity this morning to appear before the committee and to testify in support of Senate Bill number 2. My name is Gregory Conrad, and I serve as Executive Director of the Interstate Mining Compact Commission. We very much appreciate Senator Giesel's work and leadership on this legislative initiative. As you know, Alaska has been an associate member of the compact since 2006, during which time the state has had an opportunity to learn more about the benefits and services that IMCC provides to its member states. And I believe you may hear directly from Deputy Commissioner Fogels about Alaska's experience to date. And it's based on that that the state has chosen to move forward with the legislation that is necessary to bring the state into the compact as a full member. In today's legislative and regulatory climate in Washington, D.C., it is more important than ever for state governments to be heard and their concerns understood. This is as true for mining issues and related environmental concerns as any other governmental matter, such as health care or transportation and infrastructure or budgets. IMCC is recognized by many in Washington for our experience and expertise on mining issues. As an example, we've been requested to testify on behalf of the states at 6 congressional hearings in the House and Senate over the past couple of years on topics such as Good Samaritan protections for hard rock abandoned mine cleanups, stream protection requirements for surface coal mining operations, hard rock financial assurance requirements under CERCLA, legislation to enhance funding for states to reclaim abandoned coal and hard rock mines, and the impacts of the federal budget on state grant programs. We've also been consulted by the General Accountability Office and the National Academy of Sciences on a range of issues affecting the states. And we're also active on several advisory bodies, steering committees, and state-federal teams on which our member states generally serve in order to ensure their direct input. As you will note from our annual report, a copy of which I believe is included in the meeting documents for today's hearing, IMCC is regularly called upon to provide its recommendations on a plethora of issues on Capitol Hill and before the federal regulatory agencies here in D.C. These are developed by the states at IMCC meetings and conference calls and are communicated in the form of resolutions, testimony, formal comments, and of congressional staff briefings and other state-federal meetings. Without the input of our member states, none of this would be possible. It is our ability to speak with one voice on common concerns that draws the states together and gives meaning to what we do. The specific matter I would like to address today, which is probably on your minds, is why Alaska should become a full member. As with other state government organizations, it is the active participation and commitment of the full member states that carries the organization forward in terms of both support and leadership. Upon becoming a full member through the enactment of legislation that you have before you in SB 2, the state of Alaska will have a formal vote in guiding the direction of the compact. Alaska will also be in a position to chair the various standing committees of the compact and to thereby help lead the compact in directions that are favorable to both Alaska and the member states. Alaska will also continue to enjoy the many other benefits to which it has been exposed over the past 7 years, including access to all of our communications, meetings, programs, and initiatives. Alaska's participation as a full member would also be recognized and understood by those who work with the compact on a regular basis, including both the Congress and the federal agencies, and this brings a greater degree of recognition and influence regarding Alaska's participation in our work. IMCC's presence in Washington, D.C. allows us to monitor federal agency and congressional initiatives that might impact state primacy programs as well as developmental concerns on mineral resources. I believe that Alaska's participation in the organization opens avenues for the state to be heard in unique and valuable ways not otherwise available to it, and to be supported with the clout that comes from 25 states speaking together as one voice. And since IMCC is focused solely on mining and related environmental protection issues, with the federal government, we are able to delve deeper into the concerns that matter most to Alaska in this critical area of resource use and protection. I know I speak for all of the member states of the compact in encouraging your committee to seriously consider and hopefully approve SB2 to bring Alaska in as our newest full member. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have or provide additional information. And thanks for the opportunity to participate in today's hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Conrad. Questions in the committee? Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the overview. And one of the provisions of the bill, Article 3, talks about state programs, and it says each party state agrees that within a reasonable time it will formulate and establish an effective program for the conservation and use of mine land by the establishment of standards and enactment of laws or the continuing of the same in force. And then it goes on. And I don't know if you've had an opportunity to review Alaska's laws to see whether or not we already meet that or whether or not there would be additional steps that we would need to take to meet that provision.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Wilkowski. I am generally familiar with Alaska's laws and working with the Department of Natural Resources as those laws impact mining. And my understanding is that the state has robust regulations and policies in effect for the mining industry, and the IMCC would not impose in any way any additional requirements above and beyond those that the state has already adopted. We are not a regulatory body. We're a recommendatory body, and we are generally not intimately involved with states crafting or passing laws or regulations for their respective mining operations and environmental protection, but hope to provide the kind of counsel and advice that would be helpful to them in doing that.
Further?
Thank you.
Senator, anyone else? This is Chair Dyson. In my cursory glance at what we're doing here, and I didn't see anything, perhaps you can direct me to it, where the commission works on mining safety. Does it? Can you point me to it?
It is probably not reflected in the specific compact language, Mr. Chairman. It would be in the general provisions of our authority to be involved in issues that impact state governments in the area of mining. And I'm looking here through SB2 to see if I can find the specific provision. I can certainly get back to you about that without spending an inordinate amount of time searching through this right now. But mine safety and health is one of our key issues that we pursue on behalf of the states. In fact, we just had a meeting 2 weeks ago with the leadership of the Mine Safety and Health Administration here in Washington. Alaska participated in those meetings, and it is one of the key issues that we pursue on behalf of the states.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I noticed in the Article 1, sub B, parents 4, is
yeah,
where I said.
Yeah, you're right. Thank you. Mr. Conrad, we perhaps uniquely amongst your members have huge mineralized zones that cross the border into Canada. Have you all... do you have any relationship with Canadian provinces?
We do not, Mr. Chairman.
Can you hear us, Mr. Conrad?
Yes. We do not have any specific working relationships with the Canadian government or provinces.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Mr. Fogel, would you like to testify again, sir? Thank you, Mr. Conrad.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, if you can, please stand by for a few more minutes in case there's another question.
I will, sir. Thanks.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, it's a pleasure to be up here testifying before you. I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 2 that would enable Alaska to become a full member of the Interstate Mining Compact Commission. As you all know, mining has been increasing in recent years in Alaska. We do have the 7 operating mines. They're all economic contributors. They're all operating quite well. We do have a very strong regulatory and permitting program, which in our opinion is certainly in line with IMCC's enabling legislation and its requirements. But on the governor's direction, we are looking for ways to improve the way we permit and regulate our natural resource development projects. Part of this initiative is to improve our collaboration with the federal agencies that are so important and have so much impact on how we permit resource development in Alaska. And also part of that initiative is to dialogue with other state regulatory and permitting agencies to find out how their programs work and what we can learn from their programs. And this is where the Interstate Mining Compact Commission comes in and why it's so important to Alaska, in our opinion. My work with the Interstate Mining Compact Commission goes back 7 years to where Alaska first became an associate member. Interstate Mining Compact Commission brings together the permitting and regulatory programs for 25 member states. In this forum, the states exchange information on how well their programs are working so that we can learn from each other. But most importantly, the Interstate Mining Compact Commission carries with it the full weight of its 25 member states as it testifies before congressional hearings, talks with congressmen and senators in Washington, D.C., and with other federal agencies.
The Interstate Mining Compact Commission has been instrumental in working on many federal issues that are very important to Alaska and that directly affect the efficiency of our permitting and regulatory process. Some examples are the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's initiative to take over bonding for hard rock mining in the nation. There are numerous Endangered Species Act issues that are affecting a lot of the member states, including Alaska's, maybe more so than most. Monitoring of federal budgets to make sure that the federal agencies we work with have the resources to do their jobs. And as was mentioned in the prior testimony, working with the Mine Safety and Health Administration to ensure that that the safety regulations are responsible and effective for Alaska's conditions. That's been a serious concern here in Alaska. We've been afraid that the Federal Mine Safety Health Administration is not taking into account some of our remote nature of some of our mines, in particular the smaller placer operations. So we're grateful to IMCC that they just brokered a kind of one of our first big meetings with the head of the MSHA in Washington, D.C., so we could bring forward. We sent delegates to that meeting so we could bring forward some of our concerns, and especially the specific concerns to Alaska. I should mention that a lot of the issues that IMCC works on transcend the mining sector and are directly applicable to other resource development sectors as we go through our permitting and regulatory processes. Currently, I am the governor's designee to represent the state of Alaska at IMCC meetings. And as a full member, as Mr. Conrad said, we will be able to vote. We will be able to set the policy direction of IMCC. And also, the more full members that we have in the Interstate Mining Compact Commission, the more powerful its voice will be in Washington, D.C. And IMCC is growing. The state of Nevada just joined recently as an associate member and is pursuing full membership. The last meeting in October, we had the state of Montana participate to start evaluating whether it should join. And I think there's sort of a kind of a movement to get more Western states to join and sort of and take IMCC from its origins back in the Eastern states with a coal mining focus to broaden it out to the non-coal focus and to the Western focus. And I do believe that this is a very valuable tool for Alaskans to be heard in Washington, D.C. So thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Any questions for Mr. Fogle? Senator Coghill.
So that was one of the questions I was going to go to is, I know there's a growing interest in the Western states, but what is the makeup of the compact now generally? Is it mostly Eastern states of the 20-some that are in it?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, that is correct. I think the membership right now is predominantly kind of East and Midwest states. On the West, we have we're predominantly associate members: Wyoming, Nevada, Alaska, Colorado, Utah. I believe I don't have the list with me, but I think I got them all. But we're working. We're in dialogue with Idaho, and again, as I mentioned, Montana to bring in more Western states on board. I know most of the Western states have similar initiatives to bring them up to full membership also.
One last question.
Follow up.
You mentioned the small miners, small placer miners. I know Alaska at least wants to be, friendly to placer miners as best we can and still keep our water quality. Is that even an issue within some of the compact member states at this point?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, I would venture to say that Alaska, as we all kind of know, is fairly unique in probably this respect. I think the other states do have small operators, but maybe not to the extent that Alaska has. I don't know, maybe the executive director, Greg Conrad, can shed some more light. But I think that you will find smaller operators in other states, and a lot of the other states. A lot of their mining industry is made up of material, sand and gravel mining also, maybe a little more so than Alaska would be. We're special up here in Alaska. We have a very different environment and makeup of our industry.
Any further questions in committee? Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. And just looking at the composition of the membership, and there's no Western states as full members, as far as I can tell. Are the decisions made on a consensus basis, or is it require unanimity, or 50 plus 1% when they're making a decision on a position?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I might the specifics on voting, I'd like to defer that to Greg Conrad, since we, to this point, really haven't been that involved in voting, since we don't have a vote. And, we would be the first, if all goes as planned here, we would be the first Western state to join as a full member. I would like to point out that Alaska has been very, very involved in IMCC. We've been talking with the other Western states a lot about trying to really amp up Western membership in the IMCC. I think everyone's starting to see the huge potential benefits to it. So I don't know, maybe I could pass that over to Mr. Conrad to delve into the specifics on how voting is conducted at IMCC meetings.
Senator Culkin.
In Article 5, sub B, talks about at least some of the voting rights and some of the quorum requirements. So the commissioner is entitled to a vote, and most of it is majority vote.
Does that satisfy your question?
Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on this bill? And you don't need to repeat what you said earlier. We listened very carefully, but you are free to say anything you want, sir.
Thank you very much, Senator Dyson, and the rest of the committee for hearing SB2 today. Just for the record, my name is Mike Sagetry, resident of Juneau, executive director of the Council of Alaska Producers. We've supported this bill when it was working its way through the legislature last year. We are very happy to be supporting this bill again. You have our written comments. I just want to highlight one point from them. The Council of Alaska Producers has always supported a permitting and regulatory process that is rigorous, science-based, transparent, and predictable. And we absolutely believe that Alaska is a leader in permitting of mines and regulation of mines. But you don't just stay the leader. Once you're there, you have to continuously improve your processes. And one of the ways that you do this is by collaborating with your peers, in this case, collaborating with the other mining states in an official forum where policy decisions can be made and the states can work together to make all of their permitting mining permitting regimes even better when we deal with regulatory and reclamation issues. And by joining the IMCC, I think we can continue to be a leader in the permitting and regulatory arena and ultimately get some of these other Western states to join in. With that, I'd entertain any questions the committee might have.
Any questions, committee? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I have two more people that want to produce, Michael or Michelle.
No, that was Mike Sentry right there.
Yeah, okay. And Denitha Crockett, do you want to speak again?
Yes, please. Thank you. Again, my name is Deantha Crockett, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association. Same thing. I don't want to belabor what Deputy Commissioner Fogels, Greg Conrad, and Mike Sagetry all said. And you do have a copy of our letter as well for your record. But I just want to highlight a few things here. Just to reiterate again, and I know that all of you are very aware that federal regulation is becoming increasingly difficult under this current administration, and IMCC has really been the expertise as well as sort of having an ear on the ground in D.C. has been hugely beneficial. I belong to a group, it's an informal group, but called the Western States Mining Coalition, and it is the executive directors of the other Western mining states, and we try to meet once or twice a year. When this bill was first filed by Senator Giesel, I got in contact with them and asked them about their status. Some of them are associate members, as Senator Wilkowski pointed out. I do know that Utah has legislation right now through their Division of Oil, Gas, and Mining to become a full member. All of the executive directors of those groups really sang IMCC's praises and said they've been hugely beneficial for their mining industries in those states. So it really would do a lot of good for Alaska, for our regulators here, and for our industry to have access to that group. With that, I'll take any questions. But
any questions from committee members? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else like to testify on this bill? No questions from the committee? Chair will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman. I'd like to make a motion.
Senator Coghill.
I move that we vote Senate Bill number 2, A version, the compact bill out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Is there objection? Seeing none, SB 2 passes from committee with unanimously and or with no objection, and we'll take a break. And our star secretary, Nancy Jones, who's been making things run around this building for a long time. And I'd also like to introduce the gentleman that works for me. This is Ken Truitt, and he's from here in Juneau, member of the bar, a vast experience and a great add to my team and this committee. All right. So, Senator Witakowski, would you like to present SB 4?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Bill Witakowski. I'm state senator. I represent Northeast Anchorage and Elmendorf. And thank you for hearing this bill, Mr. Chairman. We've been working on this with the Department of Defense for about two plus years now. It actually passed the Senate last year, passed the House last year, but then the bodies were unable to get together and pass the bill. So we're here again. It's a top priority of the United States Department of Defense. Essentially, what it does is it directs state boards to accept relevant military education, training, and service as equivalent to some or all of the qualifications required while applying for a license or certificate. It also authorizes the issuance of temporary licenses or certificates for active duty service members who had an equivalent license and certificate issued in another state. One of the things that we've heard over the years, Mr. Chairman, and you know because you've been at some of these town hall meetings, is the employment issue for newly separated veterans is a major concern. In fact, the unemployment rates for veterans, jobless rate for post 9/11 veterans was 9.9% as of last September, with young male veterans experiencing an unemployment rate of 18.1%. So we think this will help out. This is something, this legislation is something that's being passed all across the country. I think 25 states have passed similar legislation. I know a number of other states are looking at similar legislation as well. And I just want to say for the record, this is in no way saying that UAA is not, or the University of Alaska is not doing a good job already. They are doing a very good job. This would just simply codify some requirements. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I have my staff member, Kendra Kloster, here to answer specific questions in the bill. She's been working on this for a long time.
Any questions at this point? All right, we'll come up with that question again after we've heard the testimony. Any of you that have signed up to testify have time constraints? All right, we will start with Chris Christensen from the university.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen with the University of Alaska. I'm here today to talk about Section 2 of the bill, which directs the university's president to adopt policies and procedures to award credit for military training, education, and service. And while the bill has not yet become law, I'm happy to tell you that Alaska's university is in compliance with the mandate at this time. I'd like to begin by noting that the university is committed to offering quality educational experiences to active military, to veterans, and to their families. GI Jobs, which is a magazine and web portal that specifically exists to serve people who are transitioning from military life back to the civilian world, has designated both UAA and UAF as military-friendly colleges. Only 15% of all the universities, colleges, and vocational schools in the country got this designation. which is probably the reason that the Department of Defense is pushing this legislation nationally. The web portal guidetoonlineschools.com, which bills itself as the definitive source for online education, has done a rating of military-friendly online schools. Last year, UA was rated the number 5 on this list. That's something we're very proud of. And as the entity that that made this possible by your funding decisions and other support, I think you have every right to be proud of it as well. Now, in the short time I've been with the university, the single issue I've heard about more than any other issue, including Mr. Chairman from your office, is transfer of credit. Everybody's got a story. It's a subject that arouses great passion, and military transfer credit is a piece of this bigger issue, and it's what this bill is focused on. The Board of Regents does have a written policy that says campuses must accept in transfer as much credit as is appropriate to a student's new degree and graduation requirements. All three campuses have established transfer credit policies that are designed to give maximum credit for courses and training that are taken elsewhere. We believe that awarding appropriate credit for military education and training is one of the university's core responsibilities and another way we can show our commitment to our nation's military and veterans. Now, while testifying on last year's version of this bill, I discovered that there were actually a lot of misconceptions about what how the university actually handles military transfer credit. Perhaps it would be appropriate to give the committee a very brief recap. Transfer credit processes at the university are handled at the campus level, although there is intentionally a great deal of uniformity with respect to transfer of credit for military training. All three campuses transfer credit based on recommendations made by ACE. ACE is the acronym for the American Council of Education. For over 65 years, since right after World War II, ACE has had an agreement with the Department of Defense to review military training and experience for the purposes of awarding equivalent college credit. Its recommendations on equivalent college credits are utilized by many colleges and universities across the country. Our three campuses actually have written agreements with the Department of Defense to utilize ACE's recommendations on what military service training credit equates to in the civilian world. Our three campuses are also members of the SOC Consortium. SOC stands for the Service Members Opportunity Colleges. This is a consortium of over 1,000 colleges and universities that enroll military veterans and dependents in special degree programs, both on campus and through online learning. Its purpose is to let the military get degrees instead of just accumulating credits as they transfer from base to base. Our campuses have signed written agreements to, among other things, follow specific guidelines to ease transferability of credit between member institutions and to limit the number of credits military students have to earn at UA in order to get a UA degree. For example, military students who are working on an associate's degree at UAA only need 3 UAA credits in order to earn the degree. UAA will take all the rest of the credits from other schools in the SOC consortium. UAA is currently accepting approximately 51 credits per student from those military students who attended the Community College of the Air Force, the service academies, or any of the other regionally accredited military institutions. At UAF, a military student can use approximately 30 credits of typical training for the Bachelor of Emergency Management degree, or 90 military credits for a General Studies degree. Neither UAA nor UAF have any limitation on the number of military credits they accept. They used to, but they've done away with it as part of their long-term commitment to make things easier.
Excuse me, how long ago did the university make that change?
UAF, I'm not sure. I believe UAA just did it about 2 years ago.
Thank you.
Now, I could go on, but what's the bottom line? And I don't have figures for the entire system, but UAA alone awards over 15,000 hours a year of military transfer credit for training, for education. They even award credit for time simply spent in the service. And the number is increasing every year. Last year, approximately 99.5% of the students who requested military transfer credit actually received the credit. Now, Alaska, of course, is widely known to service members as a state that welcomes and appreciates the military. I think that Alaska's university, as demonstrated by our existing transfer policies, sort of reflects the prevailing social values in this state. And, Mr. Chairman, I would note that Chancellor Tom Case of UAA is in the audience. Just in the last 12 months, since the last time this committee heard a version of this bill, UAA has done a number of new things to improve the treatment of military and veterans and their families on campus. And I'm sure Chancellor Case might be happy to tell the committee what some of those things are, if the committee's interested.
Questions, the committee? I have a couple, Chris. Both Senator Wilikowski and I are mature enough and have been around it to realize that everybody that testifies, not you, but everybody that we hear of in anecdotes, rarely tell the whole story. And slightly off this subject, but I've told that there's problems in your organization of transferring credits from one university to the other, i.e. Anchorage and Juneau. What's the truth?
Mr. Chairman, that's really an interesting question. And when I know President Gamble asked that question when he came on board a few years ago. And, you know, what people would always say is, well, it's not a problem. 98, 99% of all the credits transfer. And, you know, but, you know, there's statistics sometimes can be a little bit misleading. President Gamble has engaged in the University Strategic Direction Initiative, which is a comprehensive look at the way we're doing things, what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong. We had 80 meetings around the state with students, with faculty, with members of the community, alumni, business leaders, trying to figure out what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. And transfer credit was one of the things that was brought up on many occasions. And what we discovered is that credits do transfer. The problem is the process. It's the way they were transferring. If you're a student and you're trying to get a credit transferred from UAF down to UAA, and it takes time to do that, it doesn't matter if the credit's ultimately transferred. If you know you miss this semester's classes as a result. So instead of just talking, maybe some statistics would help show the way things have actually changed, the commitment to change.
You don't have to do that for me. I appreciate what you're doing, and I'm glad there's progress.
In 2011 at UAA, it took 45 days on average for the credit transfer process to take place. Under Chancellor Case's watch, that 45-day period has gone down to 3 days in only 2 years. UAA transferred 275,000 credits last year. That's 41% more than they transferred only 4 years earlier. They transferred in credits from 6,000 students last year, which is 65% more than 4 years earlier. So I think these statistics show that this is more than just words. There is really a commitment to change the system, and it's changed very dramatically. And if you do talk to students, I think you'll find that students now will have a very different story than students only 2 or 3 years ago.
That's heartening. Questions, comments?
Senator Wilikowski. Mr. Chair, just my staff member actually is going to UAA, and she's actually had this exact experience of being unable to transfer credits from Southeast to UAA. So I think maybe there's a very different story of what's happening on the ground than...
Sometimes credits, it's not just an issue of credit transferring, it's what the credits transfer for. Frequently, credits will transfer and people are unhappy because they're not transferring, they're transferring as general education credits, not as requirements. We have a lot of difficulty sometimes transferring credits as requirements. It depends on a lot of our times hands are tied because of accreditation issues. We have different accrediting bodies for the different universities, and this sometimes causes some of the issues. But things have dramatically improved. They're certainly not perfect. We're certainly continuing to improve them. And anytime you do have a constituent come to you and talk about a specific problem, please refer them to us. The only way we can improve the system is if we know where the problems still are. And the way we find out is when people complain.
Senator Wilikowski?
I will do that. Thank you.
Yep. So, as Christensen, I understood President Hamilton to tell me when we talked of this subject 4 or 5 years ago that a issue was that each discipline within the university had its own standards of what was acceptable within that discipline, and whose courses in that discipline and other institutions were acceptable. Has that been a problem, or did I mishear?
Mr. Chairman, I think, and Chancellor Case may be able to address this a little more detail than I can. I think it has been a problem in the past. I think in the last few years there's been a real commitment for the campuses to work together. The faculty has actually bought in to improving things and changing them. For example, right now, 100% of the general education requirement credits from UAF and UAS are being accepted at UAA. That wasn't the case just a few short years ago. Accreditation is an issue, as I said. When you have a program at UAA which is accredited by a different entity than the program at UAF, there may be some difficulty in switching some, in transferring certain of the credits. Generally, they can transfer, but not always. And that is not something we may always be able to affect.
And I'm sure I have a mistaken, as Chair Dyson, impression that the university system is kind of monolithic, and whatever the regents and the president decide will happen. But
Mr. Chairman, coming from a very different bureaucracy 20 years ago,
Mr. Christensen, go ahead.
I can say that that the university is probably the least monolithic entity I've been exposed to. And that's not just our university. That is just the way universities nationally are governed.
Yeah. So I will ask the region sometime if that's the way it should be. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any policy in place for National Guard members who are attending school and are required to be out and miss class?
That I'm not certain of, but I can find out and get back to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Chair Dyson, Senator Wilkowski and I heard some touching stories at hearings at Senator Wilkowski. One of them was a combat medic, a woman who had two or three tours as a combat medic and couldn't get credit against that, against the university's, I think, some kind of a practicum. And so we understand, appreciate what you're doing here on the transferring of college credits. Would you speak to the, whatever it's called, practicum, experience, transferability?
Mr. Chairman, I will need to get more information from you. I can't speak to that issue. I suspect, again, it might go to the particular way that program is accredited at the university, but I will do some investigating and get back to the committee.
All right. Any further questions for Mr. Christensen? Thank you, sir. Chancellor Case. Please identify yourself for the record.
For the record, I'm Tom Case, Chancellor of the University of Alaska, Anchorage.
Please proceed, sir.
Chair Dyson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here to speak to something that I feel a deep personal commitment towards, as does the university, and that is the good treatment of our military veterans. I've said before, in fact, to the legislature in prior years, in my 33 years of active duty military service, Alaska is indeed the most military-friendly state that I have ever served in. I think that commitment to our veterans is only going to increase in importance because it appears to me that we are going to be entering a time of drawdown of engagement around the world. We're going to have more veterans coming back many times from back-to-back deployments that are very, very stressful. So everything we can do to support our military veterans and active duty members is time well spent. So I just wanted to go on record as saying that. We have about 1,850 active duty and veteran students in our UAA system right now. Chris gave many of the trends that I wanted to talk to as well and reinforce. There are a couple additional ones. We have established a military and veteran student task force for taking a close look at each of our programs, and situations that come up like the one that Senator Wilkowski spoke to. In fact, we met with that student last week with a variety of our specialists to try to find out how can we make this work rather than accepting reasons from others in the system why it won't work to meet her needs. We at UA were one of 11 campuses nationwide to be accepted to participate in the Fed Success on Campus program, which we have set up and are operating. We have a new military and veteran student resource center, which I have visited and watched in action a number of times. A lot of the progress that we are making is impacted in such a positive way by prayer support from the legislature and student advising and counseling. The aspects of our budget that go towards building up our advising and counseling capacity make a tremendous difference. So those were the main things that I wanted to say. We are working very hard on the transferability of credits, and we are making great progress.
So. Excuse me. Would you comment on what I call practicum, but applicability of military experience for, like in the medical profession, where they want folks to do some hands-on work?
We are doing that. I can't give you a specific example right now, but I will provide specific examples for the record for you.
Yeah, and I would, Chair Dyson, be interested in not just specific examples of people, but the military experience that gets counted for the requirements of the university. Thank you, and I'll distribute them to committee members. Any questions for General Case? I'm impressed when Senator Welikowski and I raised these questions with you two or three years ago. And then you got back to me with a pretty impressive list. And what Chris has talked about here sounds very impressive. And I'm appreciative.
Well, as John Paul Jones said, we've only begun to fight, Mr. Chairman. We're not through yet.
Well, you're uniquely positioned with your experience to understand this one. And I appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mark Sansusi, Department of Defense. Are you online, sir?
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mark Sansusi. I am the Department of Defense Regional Liaison for Military Families for the Northwest. Sorry I can't be up there this morning, but I'm looking forward to maybe being there in person soon. I'm going to try and be value-added and not repeat things I've been hearing already since Senator Welikowski introduced this and since last year when it did pass up until the end. I'll just add some points that I have that were not mentioned. In September of 2012, the unemployment rate for young male veterans 18 to 24 was 18.1%. We'd like to think this measure will help with that in terms of occupation. And as you very well know, Alaska's home to thousands of veterans, including many of yourselves, Alaska legislators. It's a desired location for separating and retiring military members when choosing where to live after they leave the military. A 2012 Defense Manpower Data Center study reported that Alaska had 1,231 military separate or retire back to Alaska in the last fiscal year. And just in the last 2 years, as we've been discussing this issue in Alaska, over 2,500 veterans have come back from the military to call Alaska home. So at this rate, with at least 1,200 annually, you can expect you're going to get lots of highly qualified ex-military people to continue to come back to enjoy your quality of life when in trying to transition into civilian careers. I want to just emphasize a couple of things, re-emphasize a couple of things. We're not asking for direct licensure occupation, not asking for direct occupational licensure if it's not equivalent. In cases where a regulatory agency or board determines partial credit, but it saves time and expense and helps a veteran get to work towards where they're going, even if not completely, that is what we're seeking here. We're only seeking credit where credit is due. Another point is that you and I have already paid for the veterans training within the Department of Defense schools, and with the years of experience they gained while serving our nation with our federal tax dollars. Also, as more credit is given to a veteran towards licensing or a degree or certification, the more school slots can be made available to civilians, especially in programs where they may be waiting lists to get in. The Department of Defense recognizes also that if we're going to ask credentialing bodies to evaluate military training and experience, we have to make it easier for them to do so, trying to minimize any fiscal impact. And to that end, the DOD is working feverishly with the United States Department of Labor to link service transcripts of military occupations with civilian to private sector licensure requirements. And there are now six pilot states working, the regulatory agencies in six pilot states are working hard reviewing military occupations to determine whether training and experience is sufficient to be useful in rendering licensing credit in a given occupation. I can tell you the six states, but I don't know if proverbially you really want to hear that because you've heard that already about states. I would like to address what the UAA is doing and the UA system is doing. We really appreciate all that University of Alaska system is doing, and we agree with the testimony that we've heard. One bit of news I would like to impart is there's a brand new transcript that's coming out that will help our schools try and reconcile military education and training with transcripts, and it's called the JST, the Joint Service Transcript. This was just released, a press release just came out in February, and it's going to be available on March 1st to the colleges and universities. The JST will be an official transcript tool that validates and documents the recommended college credits for military professionals, their education, training courses, and occupational experience. This will be a standardized document that will make it easier for institutions to review and articulate the credits as appropriate and make it much more understandable to non-military audiences. And then finally, lots of credentials. Since there's so many credentials, the individual has completed, may be approved or accredited training programs, we're determining which credentials relate to military occupations and require training program approval or accreditation. And lots of this is through a crosswalk process linking the military occupations with state regulatory agencies and civilian occupations. And with that, I'll stand for questions. I have a lot more information, but don't want to be redundant from what you folks already know. So thank you for the opportunity to express our support for SB4.
Yeah, thank you, Mark, and for the work you do. Are there questions for Mr. Sansui? Susie? All right, thank you. Rick Davish, can you hear us, Rick?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Please identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Davidge. Most of you know me. I'm testifying today as the National Chairman for Government Affairs for Vietnam Veterans of America and as an Alaskan since 1972. First of all, let me look at this from a different point of view. Our real concern from veteran service organizations is the 90 days between the time a service member separates and hopefully finds a job, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We know now in the work that I do in the homeless veterans area that generally veterans will take about 30 days off for vacation and adjust, and then they'll begin a process of either going into schools or other trainings or finding a job. If they're successful in doing that within the 90 days, then they're going to make it. If they're not, we start losing them, either to suicide, homelessness, alcoholism, etc. So this is an initiative put on both by DOD and by National Veteran Service Organizations and the sponsors, who I thank greatly, to try to shorten that 90 days up. And as much as possible, get people who have the qualifications and experience immediately into school, and Tom Case has been marvelous on this, or immediately into work with temporary licenses, etc. That's what this is all about for us. And as some of you know, I'm a Vietnam combat medic, and I appreciate the attention to medical service, but this is something that we didn't have when we came home. I have 2 degrees from the university. I also serve on the Board of Regents, University of Alaska. And I can tell you, in the last 4 years, at the leadership of Tom Case, enormous hurdles have been set aside, moved out of the way, and there's been a wonderful embrace of both our service members and our veterans. Finally, thanks to the legislature, 2 years ago, we put two accredited veteran service officers on campus, one in Fairbanks and one in Juneau. And hopefully we'll have one on the Anchorage campus shortly. And they are heavily involved on a day-to-day basis in meeting the needs of veterans beyond their educational needs. And Tom and the university at Fairbanks and at Juneau have been enormously helpful in making that transition. That's the breadth of my testimony, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Any questions for Rick? Thank you, Rick, and thanks for the work you do. We're going to see you down here this spring?
If you're lucky.
All right. Thank you. The other people I have here are here for questions. We have people. Don Haberger from the Division of Corporate Business Professional License, Greg Cashin from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and also Jeff Selvey, the Department of Labor Executive Director, Alaska Workforce Investment Board. I have you down here as being here to answer questions. Any of you want to testify? All right, thank you, and thank you all for... I think you all are involved in this work, and I appreciate what you're doing. Any questions? Senator Giesel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of the discussion has pertained to other sections of the bill, and I want to focus on Section 1. This has to do with licensing boards and temporary licenses. On page 2, Section B, Bravo through E, Echo, deal with the activities of the regulatory boards, the professional regulatory boards. And I appreciate B2, that's Bravo 2, that refers to centralized licensing AS0801 063, which holds in place the criminal background check for licensing. I appreciate that that's there. My concern is Section D Delta, which talks about a temporary license being issued for 180 days, and while it is permissive language, the word may, it speaks of an additional 180 days. Now remember, this is a 6-month period. In reviewing statutes for the Board of Medicine and the Board of Nursing, these are two critical professions that competence is paramount. They both provide for a 6-month temporary license, but they are non-renewable. Why, is my question, is this an additional 6-month period provided for?
Yeah, thank you, Senator Giesel. And that's in the new section that's added.
It's on page 2.
No, I got it.
Okay.
I'm just looking up the top. All right. Senator Wilkowski, would you like to speak to that?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to call my staffer, Kendra Closser, to come, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Please.
For the record, Kendra Closser, staff to Senator Wilkowski. Some of this language we have come up with and working with Department of Commerce, we've actually went through this a couple years ago for spouses, and so this is similar language on transferring temporary licenses for spouses, so we were doing the same thing for the active duty military. And as we have stated here, it is May, so it really is up to the boards on whether they want to extend it for another 180 days.
Any questions, Senator Giesel?
There are boards, professional boards, who have temporary license limitations of only 30 days. My concern is if the individual is not qualifying for a permanent license after 6 months, it calls into question their ability to meet the requirements and also creates additional administrative activity for the board. it's a concern. I understand it is permissive.
Yeah.
And Don is here from the department as well, if he wants to come on up and comment on that.
Please.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Don Haberger, and I'm Director of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. Our view on this, Mr. Chairman, Senator Giesel, our view on this is that this is a policy call. You are absolutely correct. There are a variety of temporary licenses, either through statute or adopted, in some cases by regulation from a professional board. But we don't have a specific comment on the extra 180 days.
If I may, so when you produce the regulations and so on and so forth that go with us, does that get run by the state medical board or the board of nursing?
Mr. Chairman, yes. We sort of have, if you will, the 40 programs, and that's rounded, professional licenses split into boarded and unboarded. That's an easy demarcation. The legislature has given the boards authority, if you will, to regulate that profession. We don't have that. We are administrative in that regard. We can set regulations for those programs that do not have boards.
It's a policy call, Mr. Chair, and it's coming back to me now. We did have a bill that provided similar provisions to spouses, and if the committee wishes to change that or the legislature wishes to change that, we can change that. It's just a policy call.
We'll go off the record. Record, Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to offer in a conceptual amendment that would amend page 2, let me see here, line 19, beginning at line 19, after the words 480 days, a period inserted, and the rest of that phrase, and may be extended, etc., to the end of that sentence to be deleted, Mr. Chair. So that instead section D delta would read, a temporary license or certificate issued under B of this section is valid for 180 days, period.
Is there objection to that amendment? Any other discussion or questions from the committee? Chair will hear a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 4, version Hold on. Let me get to the version.
You.
Version LS28-LS0016/U as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there objection? I think it's /2. The objection? Then it has passed on the next committee referral. We are adjourned. Thank you all.